Good morning.
Good morning, Rod. It's been about a little over a year since we last had a conversation.
It's been 2 years.
2 years, okay. A lot over a year. So I just want to introduce you to our listeners. Rod, you were in Oroville for several years, and you were involved in many different projects, which I'd like you to tell us about. You were, just to give an idea to our listeners about what you've been involved in, you've been involved in NES, in a project called IRD, and in the University of Human Unity?
Right.
Tell us a little bit about those things.
So for the last 10 years, I've been here, managing to do a few interesting things. I think that NES is probably the one that has had the best success. We got an affiliation with the Central Board of Secondary Education in 2008 and started with 50 students, high school students. There was really no high school program in Oroville at that time for Tamil students that were not in the mainstream. And even the mainstream had a pretty weak upper-level secondary program at that time. So this made it possible for students both from Oroville schools and outreach schools to have a high school program, and also one of the best in the country, because the government of India just at that time introduced a radical new progressive education system for CBSE schools. And I was a principal and a teacher in the States for the past 25 years, and I saw that it was great, and we needed it. So we did it, and last year, four of the graduates from NES, who are now in bachelor's and master's programs, some of them in the University of Pondicherry, made a presentation to the governing board, which was very impressive. And we got an increase in the budget.
Was this year? This year?
Because of that, last year.
Okay, great. Congratulations.
Finally, some new buildings are being built on that campus. Mm-hmm. And the population has gone up from 50 to 100. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we could be offering a program like that to 1,000 students. And the fact that I started one in 2008 just meant that it was about 20 years too late. I mean, it could have been done along the way, you know, and one of the big problems that I had was a refusal on the part of SAIR to support it at all, and it never has.
What did the village children have to, I know there was an issue there.
Wait a minute, what issue was there?
Between SAIR and NES.
What was that issue?
I remember the school lunches stopped first, so that was...
No, that wasn't first.
When it emerged to the public.
That
for
was
us.
Like 4 or 5 years later.
Okay, so that was a little bit
so
shocking.
So we had school lunches in the beginning, and we got funding authorized by the governing board, not by Oroville and not by SAIR, but by the governing board itself. And so our project went on because it was needed, and it was recognized by the governing board, fortunately, as being valuable. Mm. SAIR didn't want to commit to it for a couple of reasons. One is that because it's a CBSE program, it has to be accountable to the government of India. Mm-hmm. And people in education in Oroville don't want to be accountable to anybody. And then, on the other hand, the financial picture would have meant that SAIR allocates money to a project which had considerable potential, and that would have meant a reduction of money.
Was this based on ideological educational principles, which you felt were progressive and they felt maybe would be pushing children towards a more consumer kind of society goals in education?
In my opinion, no. Our program is even more progressive than Oroville school programs generally, in some ways.
And the importance also of having a secondary school for the children, education is relatively free in India, but very overburdened, I assume. So where were the village children going for their secondary education?
At that time, there were no higher secondary schools in the region.
Pondicherry, perhaps?
Pondicherry, yeah. Yeah.
And so some that's where they were going?
Some of the Aurobindo Tamil kids went to Pondicherry schools.
Okay.
Now we have quite a few coming to Ness from transition.
Okay.
And we were supported by that community in Auroville because those people realized that they would have benefited from having such a program earlier. You know, that's why I said it was 20 years late, because many of our Tamil families sent their kids to Pondi.
And according to you, what is the situation today between Sayre, Ness, and...
Sayre has nothing to do with Ness,
okay,
and
so
it will never have anything to do with Ness. But the other point I was going to make is that economically it would have meant... allocating funds from the so-called mainstream schools. And Sayre's philosophy was always, we build buildings. And so they have built a lot of buildings since that time for schools. But they didn't want to build buildings for that school or allocate funds for the payment of salaries, because when you have to be accountable to the government of India, you have to hire people that have some educational credentials, and then they're in the market, so you pay them more than you have to pay volunteer Aurobindos. So that whole picture was primary in the decision of Sayre not to support it. What else
yeah,
would you like to know
that.
About that?
Tell us briefly a little bit about the IRD project.
Well,
and what it stands for.
Yeah, I was the primary coordinator and author of a rural development project, IRD, that was initiated by a group of Aurobindos with Sam Pitroda, who was the head of the Indian Knowledge Commission at that time. And the Indian Knowledge Commission was a very high-powered research group that saw Auroville as a possible site for progressive rural development. And we also saw that, some of us. It was right after the tsunami, and there were groups in Auroville that for a while entertained the possibility of setting up a rural development program that would reach out to the villages, but that didn't happen. And then this project was proposed. It was a 50 crore project to do development in 150 villages that would be integral. It would include energy and health and agriculture and village organization and you know all the aspects of development. So this was a project that was supported in terms of the idea by these high-powered Delhi groups in the government. But then that all fell through when the project came down to the ministry level, and the ministries have different budgets. And this was an integral development project. So the secretary of the Planning Commission came here, and he was very favorable, but he said the ministries will have difficulty sorting out how to fund this, and actually the Planning Commission should be the one that does it. And he promised to give us 15 crore to start up. And then there was the general global economic dip.
So history caught up. What's remaining, just briefly, remaining of that project?
One good thing that has come out of it is called the Sustainable Living Institute, SLI,
okay,
which is a small training center for Tamil Nadu government people and village, local villages to learn sustainability practices. And this is run in cooperation with Pichantikulam and Village Action. And it's a very nice little project. And there are some other projects that use a similar methodology. There's one nice one called Sunlit Futures, which has put solar pumps in 100 villages.
Mm-hmm.
and then the EcoFem project. Mm-hmm. You know, these are all not directly related to that IRD project, but IRD is now a logo in Oroville that many of these projects are associated with as a logo. Has nothing to do with the original plan.
But it's a sort of offshoot, and it goes kind of in the direction of what it was, but the
on a smaller scale.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit about the University of Human Unity.
Well, about the same time, in 2007, 2008, a small group of us decided to try to set up a platform for research that intellectual research, philosophy and linguistics and Vedic studies and that sort of thing, that would be maybe a platform that could be associated with universities in India.
Okay, so this is an online university?
And now what it turned out to be was each year we have done 8 or 12 weeks of courses here, and then those have gone online in audio and transcription form. And in 9 years, we have accumulated hundreds of hours of audio files, and we've published a few books. And we just now did a 6-week course and a 3-day seminar with participation from all over the world. Also, 3 or 4 Aurovillians attended. But that kind of a focus really interests a very small number of people locally.
So do you have like Google Hangouts where you guys discuss something and then people are alive online and are able...
No, we don't. So you just
have the recorded...
Some of us do
seminars.
Online courses, mm-hmm. and then we interact with students in different places in the world. Our website last year had about 200,000 views.
Can you give us the address or the name to look
up? Yeah, University of Human Unity.
All right, there we go. All right, so Rod, all right, that sort of situates you. Now let's talk a little bit about your last 10 years in Oroville and where that... So these are the things you've been doing,
and
now you're no longer in Oroville.
Well, I'm here
right
now.
Well, you're here.
The last 3 years I've been reducing the amount of time that I spend here. So this year it's 2 months. Last year it was about 6, and... I don't know what the future is going to be, but kind of the culmination of those things that I was just telling you about is that NESS is, since 3 years, it's been operating on its own. It has sort of found its own level. IRD is in the hands of those small projects. University of Human Unity is a seasonal thing when there are visitors here for the most part. So all of these projects, which started out with a wave of enthusiastic power and outreach potential, have settled down into their comfortable little niches.
Mm-hmm.
And I will probably continue with the University of Human Unity seasonally.
Mm.
And I'm spending more time in the mountains in the USA, where it's very nice and cool. So this time, since I've been here 2 months, I didn't have any strong, pressing engagements. It was possible to be a visitor in Oroville and to enjoy the ambience that visitors enjoy, you know, which is really nice. There's a nice energy, and the 28th of February was a beautiful occasion. And I could look at little projects going on everywhere. And you know, for example, I think that things like Mark's Coffee and Mason's Chocolate and Naturelmont jams and All of these things are really beautiful, very, very small scale, but very nice. And, you know, on the other side, on the education and rural development side, it's the same pattern. And Oroville's economy is not flourishing, and in fact, it's declining. Mm-hmm. I think there's the lowest cushion right now that there has been in decades. So economically and in terms of population growth, Oroville seems to be quite stagnant.
Mm-hmm.
The population growth during the last year was 2%. And I've done a calculation because, you know, the future is interesting to a philosopher.
So let's hear your calculation.
What I teach in the University of Human Unity is philosophy. And something very unnatural and unknown to Oroville called critical thinking. So we'll get to that in a minute. But if you look at projections for Oroville's growth based on what's happening now, human populations grow exponentially as long as there isn't some major catastrophe. And so at the current rate of 2%, there will be 5,000 people here in 20 years. And if somehow the growth rate could be boosted to 3%, then there could be 10,000 in 50 years. But how could the growth rate be boosted to even 3%? And to get, you know, to become a city, if the growth rate was boosted to 7%, there could be 10,000 in 20 years. But this is very unlikely under present conditions.
Well, Rod, if the present conditions were to expand, I don't think that Oroville would be realizing its goal at all, because, in fact, you mentioned Naturalmont and Mark's Coffee and a few other enterprises, which are fine and dandy, but to me that has nothing really to do. I mean, those are all excellence in activities, but it really has nothing to do with the economy or the social structure we're really trying to build here.
Well, what social structure are we really trying to build here?
Well, just on a purely, well, first of all, it's called Human Unity, but if I just wanted to bereft it of any of the philosophical thing, I would just say trying to streamline goodwill so it achieves its common sense goal. Means when I say common sense goals, it means, you know, that it includes the environment, it includes the people, it includes the general direction of where we're going to go.
Well, I read recently an article in Oroville Today about the so-called lines of force, the town plan, which includes lines of force, which is an architectural term in Oroville for housing hundreds and hundreds of people. And the person who's now working on that is a Spanish architect who doesn't live here. But he made the comment that these lines of force, which are architectural structures, basically, that cover pretty extensive areas of Oroville land and are mixed-use structures with residences that are high-density residences mixed with services and shops. And he said in his comments about it that this kind of, this principle of lines of force with their permeability and multi-use purposes were necessary for the realization of Oroville's ideals.
No.
And I just wanted to add, you know, what you were stating were practical goals, but if you think of Oroville's ideals as things like
architectural elements.
No, not at all. Oroville's ideals, things like transparency and the the realization of a universal self and inner being, which has no interest in propriety, to lose the proprietary sense, to be an instrument of the divine consciousness. You know, those kinds of spiritual ideals don't seem to me to depend in any way upon an architectural structure.
I couldn't agree more with you.
But when someone says that, then you see ideology. And look at the international zone, you know, which practically doesn't exist. But they have just finished a new generation of architectural iterations. There have been hundreds of them. And it seems as though the international zone has been co-opted from the beginning by architects. But the purpose of the international zone is for the nations of the world to cooperate face-to-face in a living embodiment of human unity. And if that were actually happening, as the mother foresaw, it would solve the economic problem and it would solve the population growth problem. But there has not been any effort, as far as I know, to actually realize the purpose of the international zone. And when you listen to the international zone mafia talking about, and bullying people to do this and that with respect to the land, you don't hear anything about the souls of the nations.
But Rod, don't you find that? I mean, I'm finding that in many, many different areas. So my question to you is, do you think this shift... I certainly don't remember that in the early days of Oroville. Maybe I'm naive, maybe I was a child, but I felt like there was a lot more emphasis about attitude and behavior and trying to overcome, possessiveness or try and work a little bit on the attitude. And over the years, that has given way to much more practical, material concerns. And my question to you is, was it because it was unmeasurable, the spiritual sort of aspect is unmeasurable and doesn't have a concrete value or cannot be, that we have kind of abandoned all of that and created this huge... Because actually, if we were really trying to attempt Oroville, we would just do away with everything we're doing and go back to trying to...
No, I don't think so. I think you're naive. When there was nothing here, it was very easy to have in your consciousness the ideal Oroville.
Because it was all left to the imagination.
Yeah, absolutely. And living was so simple in those days, without electricity and water, for example. Then one didn't think about all the things that one thinks about today. They weren't not even possible. I sent a question to the mother once and visited with her with a group of people in aspiration regarding growth and development. And she said to us at that time, "Now you're 30. When you're 30,000, there will be many more possibilities." Mm-hmm. And people at that time couldn't figure out what to do at all, basically. And that was before reforestation started. So I think if we really look at the ideals of Oroville, we have to realize that building the city the earth needs, in quotation marks, has to be examined, interrogated really, really deeply and sincerely. Is the city that the earth needs this one with high-density architecture crammed into a segment of Oroville, like a suburb of Delhi? Is that the city the earth needs, permeability and green values and all of those things are achieved quite well in places like Aurodam and Fraternity and Swedam.
Those are probably all illegal settlements, according to the master plan.
Yeah, these are nice little organic settlements in Oroville, and there are thousands and thousands of acres of untended land. And if Oroville adopted something like a really green city model, which would mean a sustainable city and not just one with trees in the interspaces. By the way, that architect said that to realize the ideals of Oroville, it would be necessary to eliminate completely private gardens. So what does that have to do with a green city? You know, it has something to do with the architectural structure of the lines of force, but it has nothing really to do with a green city. A green city would be a sustainable city with solar energy and water recycling on a large scale, and organic agriculture and permaculture, and individuals relating closely to the land and the region.
So what do you make of the comment that they shouldn't own private land? Do you think that's an attempt at being less possessive? How would you...
Well, people are required to buy their houses in Oroville, so I think that this reinforces the opposite of Oroville's values. You're forced to buy a house nowadays. And preferably in a high-density, high-rise building that leaks and is totally unsustainable. The last time we talked 2 years ago, we were looking at the proposal to build these buildings that have now been built, that are four-story apartment complexes, and we can read now how absolutely inefficient and unpleasant they are, and all of that ideology about high-density living in order to enhance the social values of Oroville. You know, it was all nonsense then, and it's nonsense now.
We knew it too, but one of the issues that remains, and that's primarily for the pioneering Orovillians or those that have are stewards right now, is that newcomers are not only faced with the choice of being funneled into apartment-type buildings, which cost a lot, but they can't actually build their own little hut for 4 lakhs with a floor out of sand, and then eventually, as more money comes, fix it up. Because people don't give permission for land. It's not just Lavenir. It's also the first settlers.
So let's talk about giving permission. There's another aspect of Oroville's recent history that I've been looking into, which started last year when they had something called the retreat. And there was a lot of big brouhaha about the importance of this retreat, and I was there, and Kirti was there. And so just a month or so ago, there was a meeting to revisit that event. And as a result of that retreat, some action groups were appointed to look into...
These were the priorities that the community came together found. The retreat was basically... So
this was attended by 160 people. There were governing board members there, and these action groups came out of that two-day retreat in order to revisit things like governance, town planning, growth, economy, education, youth, and the bioregion. So, there was a meeting just recently to bring together the working groups and the action groups to review the progress. And over the course of a year, there has been virtually no progress. And these action groups have run into a lot of resistance and blockages with their goals. And in an article in Oroville Today, which has covered this, there are phrases like this regarding the lack of success among the action groups because of lack of commitment among the members, lack of clarity among the members, the community is polarized on some of the issues, funds have not been approved for the projects that they wanted to do, there's a feeling that proposals have not been thought through, there are doubts about the staying power of the individuals. Their milestones were unrealistic. There was a concern that the action groups were pushing projects not related to the retreat goals. In this full-page article, there are so many of these euphemistic references that dismiss the action groups. And then in the end of that article, there's the statement made that, quote, the goals of the action groups would radically transform our lives here. So in that statement, I catch a tone of fear. Mm-hmm. Who was put in charge of assisting and supervising all of these action groups? The Working Committee. Mm-hmm. And the Working Committee is one of the most autocratic, bullying types of organizations that has ever existed since the Soviet Union, probably. And they haven't supported the action groups, but they were the ones authorized to support the action groups. And in this meeting that I attended, you could see clearly on the part of the Working Committee a general dismissal of what all of these action groups actually represent.
So you're saying that you feel that actually, and this has been shown in other places, the community comes together, makes a decision, tries to push something forward, but doesn't receive the administrative support or the authoritarian support it's required to carry it through. So that basically people are trying to tread water and hold a status quo, I would say.
Well, yeah, but I was bringing up the issue of giving permission.
Yes.
You know, it's like there are these apex groups, planning groups and governance groups and economic groups that have a considerable amount of authority and power. And if they don't give permission, if they don't somehow accede to the will of the community and accept the possibility of change, then it can't happen.
Yeah, I agree.
And so, you know, there's another article in a year ago along the same lines in Oroville Today in which the author says that the action group that was formed to make the Oroville Statistics Office was something that action group and that goal were acknowledged as a need by most Orovillians, mm-hmm. to have a statistics office. And then this author says that with respect to that, some people think statistics are not important when the thrust is spiritual. And then he says there is a possessive attitude towards data and an unwillingness to share.
That's what I've come across.
And then he says, the working groups will need to be convinced to accept the system.
Yeah, it's a
and
bit
he
alarming.
Should know because he's on one of them.
No, it's a bit strange because we put the working groups there as to help us carry out the decisions that we take, but very quickly they morph into having their own views, yeah. And then they're at, yeah. at. So, what's the way out?
So, that's why I said that they were autocratic and in a way that blocks many things.
And we don't have a system, we haven't found a system. Everybody in Orville is traumatized from the French Revolution time of people, and still today it's the preferred method is to practically carry the chair of the person in charge and carry them out because they don't willingly leave their jobs.
Right. Well, I let me tell you that 8 years ago when I came into conflict with Sire about the funding of the of New Era School, I was called before two members of the working group and given a pretty harsh working over. You know, they said to me, we're not here to break your balls, but, and they proceeded to shout, and then I proceeded to shout, and we ended up with a big shouting match. And those two people are on the working committee again today, 8 years later. Mm-hmm. So this bullying tactic, mm-hmm. you know, is very common among these groups. Mm-hmm. The you know, there's this one and there's that one in planning and in international zone and in governance, and these people are able to stay in those positions and to control Oroville only by using a very kind of hard-nosed negative tactic, so that things don't, so the boat doesn't get rocked too much. Well, but if the community really wants to change things, why does it tolerate this? And then there are articles like these ones that I've been quoting from, which tell you all of these opinions on one side and the other, but they never critically analyze why it's like that.
So let's do that a little bit, because on the other hand, I would say some people feel like, hey, there's no accountability. People are allowed to do whatever it is they want. Some people knowingly are ripping off Orville. They're not being held accountable. So I guess there's a frustration with the public, because on one hand, they feel that, hey, a little bit of a tough guy measure would be good to have a bit more honesty, transparency, etc. And on the other hand, then when that comes up, it's often used in opposition to what people are requesting.
Yeah,
so how do you see that?
In my opinion, they protect the wrong ones often, you know, because it's in the interest of the status quo for the people who have power to continue to have power.
Well, let's talk about that status quo, because perhaps sometimes the feeling I get is that people have put so much energy into getting just somewhere that they do not have a 1 ounce of energy for innovation
right.
or embetterment, and they're just trying to keep it running because they can't do more than that.
Yeah, undoubtedly, that's true. And these groups can use that to their advantage. And so then in an article, they can say that, you know, this group feels like this and that group feels like that, and there is unclarity. And then the status quo just stays like it
continues.
Is. And there's never a penetrating analysis of why it's like that. So why are the action groups really not getting support from the working groups? This is something that could be analyzed.
But let's look at the
deeply.
Criticism. They say there's no staying power in the individual. What does that mean?
It's just an opinion that's put forth as a reason to not.
And it's also pigeonholing somebody who might have just found his passion and might have incredible
right.
staying power.
So we can have all kinds of doubts about things. If we don't support anybody and give them what they need to go forward, then we can say that they lack clarity and perseverance mm-hmm. because they get frustrated and they don't achieve very much. I met with people in this statistical office. A couple of people who are primary in that group, and they say that they just are not being given access to any information.
It's true. I've had that experience firsthand, being asked to do a job by the human resource team and not being able to get, I mean, it took me many, many months to get the information
yeah.
to do the work they asked to do. But there's no statistical team, but we have a data management group that won't give you data.
Yeah, right. So let's look at that statement that I just read from the article, in which it said that some people think that statistics are not important
yeah.
when the thrust is spiritual. So if we can understand a little bit what this means, you know, if the thrust is spiritual, and that means that statistics are not important, then we can continue to support the status quo, in which, let's say, we belong to to a power group or to an elite. And we can always say that this is the mother's will. You know, Orville is
growing. Well, I had this argument with
Orville is growing according to the hidden principles of nature, and there's nothing that we can do about that. It's someday the real Orville will emerge, and so for as long as possible, you know, we have to take the stand and say our job is to keep the wrong people out of here. You know, there are some people who have made formations about what is right and wrong, and they tend to be the ones that get the government money and do what they want to do.
Mm. But oh, well, let me just take that analogy about statistics. Statistics, okay, well, it depends on where you're using it. You see, there are very practical issues. How many children are going to this school? How many children? Because I came up with this argument mm-hmm. a few years ago. I said, well, if there's only 6 people going into a certain school and 300 in another, you know, should they be equally supported? And I was told absolutely, because you know, it's the quality, and if we want to achieve that quality, those things need to be, those experiments or mm-hmm. those thrusts yeah. need to be supported as well.
That's why they didn't want to fund NASA.
Okay.
You know, I mean, why should we waste our money on the local population when we have these important experiments to do?
Well, that's because maybe Orville is getting the money in the name of those experiments. Maybe that's because it's attached to that.
Maybe.
Rod, so what do you see? Okay, so we see a status quo maintenance at the follow up of the retreat, and why things are not happening in general. We talked about general growth and development. What do you see as the next?
Yeah, well, I don't know what's next, but I would like to go back to the idea that the international zone could potentially solve many of the problems. And this was clearly the mother's idea. This is how she saw it. The active participation of developed nations, not just a few individuals from this one and that one, but the active participation.
Governments
through their cultural
attaches
and,
or whatever.
Organizations and so on, you know, which would require bridging by the government of India in a way that would give the governing board actually something meaningful to do. And if that were happening, and growth on the basis of that idea was happening, then the people coming here would theoretically have some interest in expressing the truth of their nations, experiencing each other in a living way. And I would like to introduce the idea that the soul of the nation is not something that's going to be found through any kind of research, because the principle of the soul is that it is a divine entity which is itself unmanifest. It expresses itself through forms. But when it expresses itself in a very vibrant way through forms, you see the soul behind the forms, which is infinite and beautiful and free. But you can't go into a book and you know, analyze French culture and say that Voltaire and Rousseau represent the soul of France. You know, what represents the soul of France today, nobody can say, really.
Because it's also in evolution.
But if it was here, we would see it. We would feel it.
Yeah.
You know, and some of the international zone people mm-hmm. are moving in that direction. But a lot of them have been totally stuck in this idea that first you need to do the research to find out the soul of the nation. And this is a total cop-out in my view. The mother had the idea that people would be here interacting over real things in the best ways that they can, and then each would see the other's soul through those ways of interacting. And this would be meaningful. And I think it would also have a kind of built-in security. You know, these people like that would be interested in solving regional sustainability issues, mm-hmm. you know, and they would be interested in creating forms of communication that wouldn't just be one brochure that's published every month by the same people for
it's the
decades.
Activity that would then be the soul. It would basically be not what you're creating, but what would be drawn out of it. It's like the saying, you can't make art by making art.
It has to be creative, which means spontaneous, true, energetic. So this is a beautiful idea, and if Orville were really promoting that and not just showing a new generation of drawings that show little spirals going around a geographic area where maybe someday there will be pavilions, you know, that whole architectural idea seems to me to be just
but
nonsense.
But Rod, let me ask you this. Why, I think we have the same views on all of this. I think geometry and aesthetics aestheticism have a spot, but they're really not the whole. I don't think that's the thrust of the Orville Project at all. It's totally secondary and very relevant to me. So lines of forces, for our listeners who don't know, are these large spiraling shaped buildings, lines of buildings that are supposed to give this spirally swirl to Orville, which to me is like, again, besides the point, because the whole thing of the galaxy to me is much more of a dynamic, energetic thrust and not a literal thing to be. I never viewed it as a literal thing, even though that's right. How it was displayed. So to me, it's that we're agreeing on that. But why do you think this persists? And this, we've really kind of put the hood over everybody's face, and this is, it's either this or nothing. And why does this material attachment to the aesthetic look of Orville continue to hamper our development? And why do we accept it, and why does it persist?
Attachment to the look of Orville, as it was conceived in the 60s, is of interest to a certain group that, you know, from that period, that has had that experience at that time. And I think that's a good symbol of a general pattern that we see, in which almost everything that the mother said about Orville in those days has become an ideology far removed from what she was actually saying. And it's much easier to hold on to that kind of a formation than it is to actually do the things that she was saying. And as people grow into a certain level of power and stability on the basis of their ideologies, it becomes less and less likely that the actual truth in anything that the mother said is going to be realized. And this has been true. It was true in communism. It was true in earlier, more idealistic periods of society. And so the why is a big why. You know, it has to do with patterns of human development that have become ingrained over thousands of generations. And the mother is challenging us to break down those patterns. And that's the real spiritual thrust, to break down those patterns. But if we use spiritual thrust as an excuse to not look at statistics, to not look at economic growth, to not look at anything, then we're just using spiritual...
It as a blanket, as a carpet to stuff all our crap underneath.
Is an ideological excuse to keep the status quo.
Yeah. Well, then I'm going back to what you were talking about. Like, it's true, there's all these wonderful coffee shops and jam makers and everything of that. But if we haven't even come to step one of what goods and services and how we're going to exchange them about each other, we've not built anything new. We haven't done what we came here to do.
Right.
We are expanding, and we're creative, and we're creating a lot of things. But the essential point of what we came to do, we haven't done.
It's like a little corner of Santa Cruz. You know, we can get some nice coffee and chocolate and pizza, and we have palm trees. And it's lovely.
But that's not building Orville, right?
And people who come here in the winter season for vacation love it. So that's what it is now. That's what Orville has become. And we are doing a few little service projects in the local region that are meaningful. And we are only 2,000 people. So my question was, how do we move the growth rate from 2% to 3 or 5 or 7%, and at the same time move Orville in the direction that it's actually meant to be going in? This is an important question, I think, and I don't think it can be answered without really serious thinking, imagining,
and statistics,
and being inspired. And the first level of thinking, imagining, and being inspired is having the data. And, you know, when you have data, it tends to circulate in the mind until it sort of falls into shapes that have meaning.
Exactly.
And then suddenly, when you have meaning, then you have a motivation to do something. And probably that doing something is going to push some people's buttons, you know, and then you're going to have to get them to accept that it has to be done. And then maybe the patterns will begin to change.
Well, that's exactly why I love statistics.
I don't see this happening anytime soon, I'm afraid.
No, because they're based on facts, and I know people say statistics lie, but there's a lot of things that statistics reveal, and a lack of progress might be one of them. And I think it's really important.
You know, the nations are meeting in April in Europe to actually sign agreements, which they had made back in November. But on Earth Day this year in Paris, all the nations are supposed to actually sign commitments regarding climate change. And this would be a really unique opportunity for a resolution to be passed with respect to Oroville that advocates making something here that is meaningful in the context of the world today, what the Earth really needs today. And if that happened, it would start to change some of the patterns that are in place here, probably in a very positive way. But it's probably not going to happen because...
But then you agree with me then part of the things that what is really needed in the world today, aside from the food and the housing and all of the usual things, what is really needed, what the world doesn't have, because we have inventors, mm-hmm. we have good businessmen, we have good educators, we have all of these things. Mm-hmm. What we don't have is an intelligent dialogue between conflicting nations or people or persons.
Well, not only that, but the spiritual thrust is missing. You know, it takes an inspiration to change these patterns. Dialogue isn't enough. Habermas is wrong. Communicative action isn't going to change anything radically.
It helps.
It's a starting point. And then you get to really critical thinking. And then you get to a higher kind of global, universalized grasp of things. And then you start tuning in to the forces that can actually change things. So that spiritual thrust is a possibility. And we would need to take those steps, you know, and to make that just a reality and not just an excuse for maintaining the status quo. This is a problem faced everywhere in the world, not just here.
So that's the challenge ahead.
It is.
Thank you, Rod.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.